Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Today, my guest is Dr. David DeSteno, a professor of psychology at Northeastern University. He is a fellow of the American Psychological Association, where he is the editor-in-chief of the journal Emotion. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Pacific Standard, among others. Today we will be discussing his insightful book entitled Emotional Success, The Power of Gratitude, Compassion, and Pride. Thank you so much, David, for being on my show.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Well, I've really enjoyed your book, and I think you have a lot of keen insights to give us, especially when it comes to a new understanding of willpower and emotion and how we can gain a lot more success using certain emotions properly. Maybe you can a little bit explain why willpower is not sustainable.
Sure. Well, you know, willpower has been held up as the way to get ourselves to persevere toward long-term goals for a long time. And it can certainly work. I'm not saying that it can't work. We've all had experiences where it does. But it tends to be a more fragile and limited way to get there for a few reasons. One is that a lot of research has shown that it is very difficult to maintain over time. That is, every time I'm trying to delay gratification to make myself want to, you know, go to the gym instead of sit at home on the couch or study for an exam or practice an instrument rather than go out and have fun. The cost of repeatedly trying to do that, the brain perceives as very effortful. And what we know over time is that our ability to maintain that willpower, to persevere in the face of temptations, runs out. So, you know, there's lots of work showing that on average, you know, about 20% of the time we try and resist temptation, we fall prey to it. For things that really matter, things like New Year's resolutions, the stats are even worse, 25% fail in the first week. And what we know is that it's just hard to always try to fight your own impulses. And so a better way, I think, to actually work at persevering toward our future goals is to make the mind value those future goals more in the first place, right? Change what we value. And if we value them more, whether it's, you know, becoming more healthy or saving money for retirement or working harder to achieve a goal, if we value that future goal more than present satisfaction, it just becomes easier to do. It's not a mental combat. And I think that's what using these emotions do.
Yeah, what I really appreciate about what you had to say was gratitude, compassion, and pride are sort of like, it's a little bit like a perspective change. And when you focus on those mm-hmm. emotions, it gives you sort of a lot more resources to move to be future thinking. And they're, you mentioned that they're not luxury emotions, that they're necessary skills. Maybe you mm-hmm. can unpack that a little.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, if you think about where self-control really came from, right, it didn't evolve to help us, you know, save for retirement or to do well on the SATs or to do the whole 30, right? None of that, for most of our evolutionary history, none of that existed. And really what it was originally about was cooperation, right? What has led to human success for millennia is the ability to cooperate with other people, to be fair, to be generous, to repay our debts, to help people. And all of those things take some cost in the moment to do, but they ensure that we have the relationships that help us over time. And so there are these moral emotions, things that you're saying that aren't luxuries, that are necessary, that underlie this behavior for long periods of time. When we're grateful, you know, we have work, which I'm sure we'll get to, which it shows that people are more willing to sacrifice to help others. When we're feeling compassion, more willing to help others. Same with pride. And so what these emotions do is they make us value the future, even though we're not consciously aware of it. They make us willing to sacrifice in the moment to help other people, which ensures our future success. But in so doing, they can also help us help another person, cooperate with another person, and that is our own future selves. And so if we cultivate these emotions, what we're doing is making the mind value the future, making it easier to persevere toward our goals, making us willing to sacrifice more in the moment to achieve them. And so they kind of accomplish what willpower does without the fight.
And the more energy we can save not having to deal with this fight of willpower, the more we have to persist in our goals.
Yeah, and actually the easier it is in our body. One of the things that we're seeing over time is that you know, trying to rely on willpower to make us resist temptation in the moment and force us to follow persevere toward a future goal, is that it can be very stressful. And that stress takes a toll on the body over time. Whereas when you look at what these emotions do, so things like gratitude and compassion, they typically reduce heart rate, reduce stress hormone output. They increase immunity and sleeping ease and comfort. And basically what they're doing is keeping the body in a more healthy, resilient state to achieve our goals, because we're not trying to overcome a short-term desire. We're actually making our minds desire long-term success more than that short-term pleasure. And that just makes it easier to do.
Is that what you term feed forward states? Or maybe you can explain what that entails.
Feed forward state. Yeah. So, you know, one of the most central challenges we all face in lots of areas of life is this thing that economists and psychologists call intertemporal choice. And what that basically is decisions that have different consequences as time unfolds. So, you know, do I save money now or put it away for retirement when it'll grow and I'll need it? Or do I buy the new iPhone 10? Do I go to the gym or do I have fun, you know, binging on Ben and Jerry's ice cream right now? And Walter Mischel's classic marshmallow test study, which I think most people know, is an example of that for kids. You know, you can have one marshmallow now, but if you eat it now, then you're not going to get two later. And so a lot of life is about trying to value the future more than the present. And that takes patience and self-control. And really, it's not just in terms of money or health, it's in terms of everything we do, right? Morality is the biggest intertemporal choice of all. If I'm loyal to someone, if I keep my promises to them rather than cheat them, I'm sacrificing some gain in the moment, but in the long term, it's a better thing. So if I borrowed $10 from you, Lisa, and I didn't pay you back, I'd be $10 ahead in the moment, but you would never want to interact with me again. And so I would lose all the long-term benefits that would come. And so what these emotions do is, by making us focus on the future, they make us more willing to repay our debts, to invest in others. And what we've shown now is they also make us more willing to value anything in the future, right? So in our experiments, they make people more willing to rather than get smaller amounts of money in the present, they're more willing, when they feel grateful or proud, to wait for larger rewards in the future. They're more willing to work on their own tasks that are hard now to get better in the future. And so these emotions are really, they're feed forward in the sense that they make us value the future more, and they ease our path, or they ease our choice to following that path rather than indulging our pleasures in the moment.
One of the things I really enjoyed about your book, and many books that I read that I get a lot out of, are the case studies and experiments and things like that. Mm-hmm. And you have plenty of them in there. And one of them that was so interesting was how meditation helped in different situations and different experiments. And there was the one experiment about compassion and the waiting room experiments. And
sure.
So these states can be made stronger in us and strengthened in us with focus and attention and meditation. And I thought that was really fascinating. Maybe you could talk a little bit about those experiments.
Sure. So as you said, this was on compassion. And if you read the New York Times or the Atlantic, what you'll see is that, you know, meditation, mindfulness is pretty trendy the past couple of years. It'll increase your creativity, it'll lower your blood pressure, and it'll do all these great things, and it certainly does. But that's, again, not why it was created, right? It was created to enhance ethical behavior. Again, you know, the Buddha and the other meditation teachers didn't care about your 401k. And so for a long time, what people had been interested in studying meditation was how it affects things like memory, et cetera, and attention. But we thought, well, if it was really designed to increase ethical behavior, which requires self-control, then let's put that to the test. And so what we did, to tell you about this experiment, is we recruited people from the Boston area for an 8-week study on meditation. And the only requirement was that they had never meditated before. And we assigned half of them to complete 8 weeks of meditation with a Buddhist Lama, and the other half were put on a wait list. And at the end of 8 weeks, we brought them into our lab and we told them, you know, we're going to do some memory tests on you, which made sense to them. But in actuality, that's not what we were looking at. The experiment actually began when they entered the waiting room. And so when you entered the waiting room in our lab. It's like a little typical lounge. There were three chairs, and there were two chairs that were filled by other people who were actors who worked for us. And so when the real subject came in, he or she just, you know, took the third chair. About 2 minutes later, the door opened, and in came another actor who was a woman on crutches wearing one of those boots you wear on your foot when you break in your ankle. And she comes down the hall into the room, and she's wincing in pain. And our two actors were told to ignore her. So they're thumbing on their smartphones or just totally ignoring her. And she comes in, and there's no chair. And she looks a bit forlorn, and she kind of just leans up against the wall and lets out a sigh. And so the question here was, what would the subject actually do, right? If meditation actually increases compassionate behavior, which requires some self-control to give up your comfort in the moment to give your seat to this person, then that's what they should do. And in the control condition, those who had been on the wait list, we saw that about 15% of people gave their chair to this other person. But in the meditation condition, you know, we tripled that. About 50% of people just got up and gave their chair to this person because they were feeling more compassion for her plight. And, you know, to us, that was a clear example of being willing to sacrifice your own immediate, you know, satisfaction in the moment to aid another person.
Now, would you say as to what is happening in the brain that would cause the change, that would make someone's behavior different? Is that, do you think, a matter of focus and creating pathways in the brain that are just more ready and aware?
I don't think it was, and we don't have the data on this, we're looking at this now, but I don't think it really had to do with attention, because the way the situation was structured, you couldn't help but see this person. She came in, she stood in front of you, she was in, you know, in pain. And, you know, if anything, the other people ignoring her is something we call in psychology a bystander study, that is, where somebody needs help and other people are ignoring this person, that actually makes helping much less frequent, because people tend to assume, well, if nobody else is helping, why should I? So I don't think it had to do with attention at all. I think what the meditation does is it increases people's willingness and readiness to experience compassion. And if you talk to the monks, this is what they will say it does as well. And what these emotions do, whether it's compassion or gratitude or a true sense of pride, not hubris, but, you know, pride in the abilities you actually have, just feeling those emotions makes us willing to invest and sacrifice to help other people, including our own future self. And so for me, by making people more ready to feel these emotions, you know, what does an emotion do? An emotion kind of sets your expectations for what's coming and how you should behave in the next moment. So if we're nervous, right, we're going to respond to any creepy sound we hear as it's, oh my goodness, it's more of a threat, and we feel that adrenaline. If you're feeling compassion or gratitude when you see someone who needs help, it automatically nudges the mind to be willing to sacrifice to do that. And again, you know, the reason here is, how is helping this person in the moment really helping me in the future? Well, what it's doing is it's building a social relationship, or potentially doing one, that if and when it comes time for you later to need help, by the simple fact of sacrificing to help others, you have built a reputation of being a person who's, you know, worthwhile to help yourself, and you'll get those benefits down the line. And there are lots of evolutionary models that show that to be true.
Right. So maybe in the brain, the readying piece is that the meditation is sort of priming the expectation, or priming the emotional response is kind of.
I think it is. I think it's one tool to make it easier for you to cultivate compassion in your life. And there are other ways that, you know, that you cultivate gratitude, et cetera. And, you know, we have a study where we followed people for 3 weeks in their daily lives and measured how frequently they felt, you know, gratitude versus other emotions, including happiness. At the end of those 3 weeks, we did a similar financial task like I described before, where people could get more money later or smaller amounts of money now. It's an adult analog of the marshmallow test. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that people who tend to experience more gratitude in their daily lives had more self-control, valued the future more, were more patient when it came to that financial task. And so the more often you feel these emotions, they're kind of like inoculations, or not, or kind of like, sorry, like vaccines to increase self-control, booster shots, if you will, they make it more likely that you'll experience those emotions in the right circumstances, and that they will increase your ability to have patience and perseverance when you need it.
Yeah, that's very compelling. Also, I have a question that if, say, the person's in the waiting room and they see this person in pain and they're sort of primed to feel like, you know, if I were that person, I would want a seat, and they give up their chair. But in the moment, they're probably not thinking, well, I'm going to probably run into this person later and then they'll help me. No. They probably are just reacting. Right?
They are. And that's what emotions do, right? I mean, they're in some ways shortcuts. What they do is they nudge us toward what I will call adaptive behaviors, which are behaviors that lead to better outcomes for us. And so, you know, we're all quite familiar with the feeling of, you know, when you feel disgusted at something, that you're the food that you see in front of you, why do you feel disgusted? So you don't eat something that's going to make you sick. But for humans, right, surviving in this world and thriving in this world isn't just about avoiding eating disgusting substances or, you know, not getting attacked by someone with, you know, when you feel fear. It's about managing the social landscape and building social relationships. And that means that you have to be willing to invest in other people. And so you're exactly right. When people feel compassion, it's not like they're consciously thinking, I should help this person because they will help me down the line. No, it's just making us behave in that way, which will ensure that behavior without us having to go through the strategic planning of it all.
There's a part that relates to that in the book around page 100, and it talks about punishing people, and it talks about like people being able to cheat and punish people by putting money into a pot. And I thought it was fantastic example of like who will sort of be aggressively punished in terms of compassion or not. I'm not sure if you know which things I'm referring to here, but it was talking about Nowak and his colleagues deduced a series of experiments where people played multiple rounds of a computer game where they randomly were paired with others. And would you mind going over a little bit of what was being tweezed out at that experiment?
Sure. So Martin Nowak at Harvard he's an evolutionary biologist who does a lot of statistical modeling. And, you know, when people, so to take a step back, when people ask, you know, what's a better strategy to be successful? Should I be a nice guy or should I be a jerk? And I say, well, it depends on your time frame. If you want to be successful in the short run, then be a jerk. But if you want to be successful in the long run, which is what most of us want, then it's better to be a nice guy. And so what Nowak and his colleagues did is they run these models where they have people play these games, oftentimes economic games, where, to make a long story short, you can choose to cooperate, you can choose to cheat other people, you can choose to punish other people if they don't cheat, if they cheat, etc. And so what he tends to find is that people who cheat, people who exploit and take advantage of others, if you look at the resources they collect, immediately the people who are cheaters, who are deceitful, who aren't loyal, who exploit others, get a lot of resources. And so in the short run, you can climb the ladder very rapidly if you exploit other people. But over time, you develop a reputation that is as someone that no one wants to cooperate with. And once people stop cooperating with you, you lose all the benefits that come with cooperation. And so over time, people who are deceitful and selfish, their outcomes fall. And the people who are cooperative are the people who actually do better in the long run. Again, that's why I always say these emotions make us choose behaviors that require some sacrifice in the short term, but in the long run, through aggregated gains of being honest and fair to lots of people, we all do well together. And so that's what those models show. But to your point about punishment, what the models also show is that people who punish others rather than show some degree of forgiveness actually do poorly on average as a whole. And you can see why. So if you and I are working together on a project and I don't hold up my end, not because I was trying to cheat you, but because I was sick or I forgot. And it doesn't mean that I am actually a bad person. It's just, it was a mistake. If you then punish me for it, that's going to ruin that relationship and we're never going to work together again. But if you're willing to forgive me, then that relationship will keep going and will repair itself, and over time will be a better outcome for both of us. And that doesn't mean constant forgiveness. If a person proves him or herself to be untrustworthy, then you surely don't want to interact with them. But, you know, but not being ready to punish someone, but showing some level of forgiveness leads to the best outcomes overall. And again, you know, that's where having compassion and empathy can play a role. Again, it doesn't mean being compassionate so that you're a doormat, but it means showing some compassion for other people's plights.
Because showing compassion in terms of sort of forgiving and forgetting will show you to be a cooperative partner.
Show you to be a cooperative partner and someone who people can rely on. And it prevents relationships from being ruined through just, you know, mistakes or noise in the system, as opposed to someone intentionally trying to cheat or exploit you.
Now, pride is one of these things that, you know, has been this co-opted word with a lot of negativity, sometimes with hubris and, you know, some braggadocious, arrogant jerk. But the pride you talk about is quite different. And maybe I should have addressed this a little bit earlier, but pride is the other successful emotion we can mm-hmm. have. And maybe you could just unpack sure. it a little.
Sure. Yeah. I think when people hear the word pride, it often kind of primes in many of us this idea of arrogance or hubris, which is problematic. But if you think about it, you know, there are expressions like people take pride in their work or pride in their abilities. And I think if the pride is attached to skills that you actually have and have earned, then it can be a very positive thing, right? And so let me give you some, I mean, I'm a scientist, let me give you some examples to back this up. And so, you know, in our lab, what we'll do is we'll bring people in and we'll have them work on these very difficult tasks, doing the spatial reasoning. And we'll tell people, some people, that, you know what, you have done really well on this task, and it's very impressive. This is an important task, and we kind of give them a sense of that we're proud of them for spending the time on this and doing well. And then versus other people who we don't do that for. And what you'll see is that the people who are led to feel proud will persevere longer when given the opportunity in the future to work on these problems, up to 40% longer, because they are getting the sense that this is a valuable skill to have. It gives them a sense of status within the group and that they can feel proud of. Now, it's true in this case we're telling them that they have the skill, so they actually don't. But they believe they do, and everybody else believes that they do. And so it is an authentic experience of pride to them. And they will work hard in this task. And then if we then put them in a situation where they're working with other people and they're feeling proud about this ability, the people who are feeling proud about their ability will tend to start motivating the group to perform well. They'll actually take on a leadership role in the group and try and encourage everybody else to do well. And the other people recognize this sense of pride. So they don't know that this person actually has a better ability. They just see this person expressing pride and confidence in their work. And not only do they see this person as a better group leader in helping this group solve this difficult problem, but they actually like them for it, right? And so pride is very attractive. Now, if the experiment went on and it became clear that the person actually didn't have these abilities that we told them they had, then it would be seen as arrogance, right? And then all the benefits would go away. But we were just creating an experimental analog for real life. And so the story here is if you have a skill and you're showing pride in it, people view that as attractive. And pride, again, motivates people to hone skills that are valuable to those around them, because that leads to success for everyone. And you might say, well, yeah, but people can also be proud of their own things. Like, you know, I might be the world's greatest, you know, basket weaver and nobody else really cares, right? But I'm proud of it. And I think that ability comes because humans have this somewhat unique ability to take a third person stance on ourselves. That is, we can be our own audience. And so we can be proud of things that we ourselves care about. But where pride originally comes from is developing an ability that those around you in the group care about. And when you feel proud for that ability, you'll work hard, spend longer hours to actually hone it, because it leads to better long-term outcomes for you to be valued by the group. And so, you know, what does our work suggest? It suggests that when you're proud, you will persevere longer at difficult tasks. In some ways, right, that emotion is what gives you, you know, to borrow Angela Duckworth's term, grit, right, to persevere in the face of difficulty and to keep going.
Yeah, and I do want to touch on grit and loneliness as we move along in this interview, in this talk. But one of the things about pride that seemed to really stick out is this piece of self-efficacy, and it's just confidence in what you know you can do well, which is like you can prove you can do something well, and that makes you feel happy about that, and then you feel like you have more, there's more meaning, and you can contribute. And
yeah, but importantly, right, it's not just self-efficacy. It's not just knowing you can do it. So in those experiments I was telling you about, so there was a condition where people did well, and we gave them, you know, social acclaim and pats on the back and said, this, you know, you did really well. There were other conditions where the computer just gave them feedback and said, you know, you did very well on this task. And in that case, that didn't increase perseverance, even though they knew that they could do it. And the reason why was, you know, this was a difficult task. Nobody really wanted to do it. So knowing you can do it wasn't enough. Feeling efficacious wasn't enough to make you want to work hard. It was actually feeling the pride that from others kind of showing acclaim and appreciation to you that made you suddenly value this task and to want to go on. So self-efficacy is important, but alone it's not enough, right? You have to actually feel the pride, whether it's your own pride or the value others place on it, to actually motivate you to keep persevering in the face of difficulty.
Okay, so the social component is important, but it doesn't always have to be there.
Right. Well, it doesn't always have to be there in the sense that because we can be proud of our own abilities, we can kind of be our own audience. So it does always have to be there. But if it's something that I care about deeply, like if I really want to be the world's best violinist, I care about that. And I will be proud of the steps I make along the way. But for other things that I don't necessarily care about, here's the thing. When you're a child, how do you know what's important to care about? The way that you begin to learn what's important to care about is by what others care about, right? We socialize our children automatically by the things that we show value in. And so kids will want to please their parents in behaviors that those parents give them credit and praise for. And over time, you know, we may develop things that we ourselves idiosyncratically care about. But initially, we're proud of our drawing or of our singing or whatever it is that we do as little children when our parents give us recognition for it, because that marks it as a valued thing to the group that we care about, which is initially our parents and then our friends, right? What is peer pressure? Peer pressure is actually working on something that those around you care about, whether or not you initially care about it, but we come to internalize those goals over time. And hopefully it's the things that our peers care about are good things, but we've seen peer pressure work in ways where it's not things that most of us consider good, yet we still want to succeed at them because we fit in better with those around us when they value the domains that we're excelling in.
Well, at this point, I'd love to read a portion from page 143 and have you talk a little bit about it, because I feel like this is a real nugget that is a great part of the book that I think a lot of people will get quite a bit out of your book, but I wanted you to explain a little bit about grit and loneliness and the moral emotions, you know, the power of these moral emotions. It says on page 143, right, throughout this book, I have offered two interrelated arguments. The first is that behaving virtuously, being honest, fair, diligent, cooperative, leads to better outcomes down the line than does being immediately self-serving. The second is that morally toned emotions such as gratitude, compassion, and pride give us the self-control that builds relationships with others and benefits our own future selves. What I haven't yet said is that enhancing social relationships offers two additional boons. The first is that social bonds on their own build grit. The second is that they simultaneously help us combat one of the most painful plagues of modern life, loneliness. And I would love you to speak a little bit to that, because that is a real thing that's come up a lot in some of the conversations I've had and some of the previous episodes I've done, that these emotions, of course, you know, we're social mammals and we have a lot of emotions, but sometimes in our plans to succeed or in our ambitions to succeed, we don't see how integral all those things are to each other.
Sure. Okay. So, I mean, the way to think about this is first let me tackle what I mean by grit, right? So grit is the ability to kind of persevere in the face of challenges, right? It's to be future oriented, to work hard to achieve your goals. The question is how, and I think that is extremely important. And I agree that that's a way to success. The question is, how do we do that? How do we best do that? Because typically, I mean, truthfully, and you know, Angela Duckworth says this herself, the idea of grit isn't tied to any specific type of, you know, virtuous social connection, right? So you can be a gritty evil genius. You can have you can have goals to, like, you know, be malicious and become emperor of the universe and do that. But more typically, I think the problem with grit is that the way we typically follow it is this kind of nose to the grindstone atomistic path where we're using willpower and trying to develop habits that focuses us really in on our work. And when we do that, in many ways, we tend to sacrifice the social relationships that we have around us by the single-mindedness. And one clear example of this is, so if you look at grit is highly correlated with this other personality trait called conscientiousness, so much so that people argue they're almost the same thing. If you look at grit and conscientiousness, what you see is that they kind of have an inverted U relationship with well-being. So as you're going from low levels to medium levels, well-being gets better. But as you approach high levels, well-being goes down. And the reason that is, I think, is because people become so focused on their goals that they tend to lose the social connection that is important for success. And so, you know, people who have grit fail less often. It's true, because they work harder. But when they do fail, it hits their well-being. Their well-being declines 120% more than the rest of us. And I think it's because they don't have those social relationships to kind of catch them when they fall. And so my argument in pursuing grit through using these emotions that make you value the future, that make you more willing to persevere, they also, and I say this in lots of areas of the book, they also automatically build social relationships. So when you feel grateful, yes, you value the future more. Yes, you'll persevere more toward your own idiosyncratic goals. But those emotions automatically make you more willing to help other people and to cooperate with them and to build those relationships so that when those bumps in the road come, we have those social relationships that will protect us. You know, today, 53% of people report being lonely in their professional lives. And I think it's because of the way we're trying to pursue our goals, as opposed to cultivating these moral emotions that connect us to others. And I always say, you know, these emotions, what they'll do is they'll give you grit, but they'll also give you grace. That is, they make you willing to work hard, but they also make you behave in ways that attract others to you and want to support you. You know, to borrow a term from David Brooks, they maximize not only your resume virtues, but your eulogy ones, those that you want to be remembered for. And I think that's what's missing in our current focus on kind of, you know, willpower and habit building and ultimate focus to drive success. It's that a lot of our success depends on interactions with others. And as you hinted at earlier, when we experience these emotions, they lead other people to experience them too. So if I'm feeling compassion toward you and I help you, you will then feel grateful to me. And these emotions begin to flow in a network, and they begin to increase the social connection in that network, and they begin to kind of support everybody overall, I think, which makes for a more robust and resilient environment in which to pursue our goals.
And for people who will be waiting in the mail for your book, waiting for the mail to come with your book in the mail.
Yeah.
What do you think are some of the ways we can just begin to take first couple steps in the direction of developing these emotions of gratitude, compassion, and pride?
Sure. So let me start with gratitude. Gratitude, the easiest way, realistically, is to do what I call gratitude journaling or gratitude keeping a gratitude diary, and that is reflecting every day or two on things for which you're grateful. Now, the important trick here, you know, we all have the few things in our lives for which we have incredible gratitude for. But if you're always thinking about those three or four things, they're going to lose their power over time. You're going to habituate to them. And so what you want to do is reflect daily on just little things that people have done for you. Did somebody help you by giving you directions. Somebody let you into traffic on the highway when you were waiting to get in. Somebody hold the door for you. You know, these are the types of things that you can feel grateful for. And in our work, you know, give the same type of effects as, you know, the things that we're most grateful for in our lives. The other thing too is simply help other people, because they'll help you back, and that will also make you feel more grateful in general. Compassion, there are a few ways. One way, as we've hinted on, is practicing mindfulness and meditation over a few weeks begins to increase the compassion and empathy we have for others. Another way is to also show self-compassion. And that is, when we are pursuing our goals, we're all going to have setbacks. And rather than be incredibly critical of ourselves, as long as, you know, our intent was to do well and to work hard, when we have a failing, we should treat our own selves with compassion. And there's lots of great work, some of it by Serena Chen, is a psychologist at UC Berkeley and other places, that's shown that individuals who treat themselves with self-compassion tend to have better track records in actually achieving their goals, because they don't get caught in these self-criticism loops. A third, for pride, it's important to actually celebrate steps along the way. Many of us will set ourselves a goal and we refuse to allow ourselves to feel proud until we reach that goal, which means most of the year as we're working toward this goal, we're going to be frustrated that we haven't gotten there. And so it's better to be proud and celebrate your own kind of baby steps along the way. Because if you don't, that's what keeps you going, right? So even in our studies, when people were doing these difficult tasks that we led them to feel proud of, they would make mistakes, but we would reinforce that they're, in general, they're doing well, and at this stage they're doing well, and that would help them to keep persevering rather than engaging in self-criticism. And again, share that pride with other people. You know, give people acclaim for what they do, right? Don't be envious. Give them feeling, help them feel pride in what they do, because they'll return the favor. And again, because these are social emotions, one easy way to feel pride is to have others recognize your behavior. And so you want to cultivate relationships where we can support each other and be generous to each other in that way.
So I'm curious to ask you, do you have any mindfulness practices of your own that you do on a regular basis?
Yeah. Should I? Yes. Do I? No. But every day I am more motivated to do it. And I actually have started. So for a lot of people, right, the problem with mindfulness is, How do we find the time and the expertise to train? And so, you know, in that one study we talked about, we had them train with a Buddhist Lama, but not everybody has access to a Buddhist Lama, either in terms of time or money to do it. And so we replicated that finding using a mindfulness app called Headspace. And the reason we chose Headspace is because it was designed by a guy who actually had some a good deal of monastic training. And we replicated the effect. So that is, you know, using my Headspace or a similar app, I would assume, on your smartphone and practicing, you know, 15, 30 minutes a day actually produces similar results. And that's a way that anybody has access to. If you have, you know, if you have a computer with internet connection or a smartphone, you can get it for like $2. And so I recommend doing it. And I have started to do that. And I think that's an easy way to cultivate mindfulness and the compassion that comes with it.
Yeah, and I think too. If we make it too complicated, we can keep pushing it off. Like I'm just thinking for myself, trying to cultivate mindful awareness of just like, where am I now, right in this moment? What is my body feeling? You know, take a couple breaths, because just in doing that, you can yank yourself back to where you are and be more mindful of, hopefully, of those emotions, those three emotions you're saying. But a lot of times we're just kind of stuck in our head and not being as aware as we could be. So
yeah, the trick is to actually begin to make these emotions kind of habits. Because so, you know, people talk about habits as ways to increase long-term success. If I build a habit to study, then you know what, I'll be more likely to continue to study. And that's true. But if you build these emotions, but the problem with that is, because I build a habit to study, it doesn't mean I'm going to then have a habit to save money or to resist, you know, binging on chocolate chips. But if you make these emotions a habit, they generalize to all types of behaviors that require temptation. So if I build a habit to be more grateful in my life, not only will it make me more likely to help and repay others, it will also make me more likely to invest my money. It will also make me more likely to, you know, eat broccoli rather than Ben and Jerry's ice cream. And so, you know, it's a more robust kind of way to help oneself by learning how to cultivate these states in your daily life.
Well, do you have any final words of wisdom as we come to the end of our conversation?
I would say my words of wisdom are for people to not to assume that you know, willpower is a bad thing. It's certainly a good thing. My argument is, and so is valuing the future over the present. My argument is that if we want to be successful in doing this right now, we're kind of fighting with one hand tied behind our back, and it's actually the stronger hand, and that is these emotional states, which aren't as common as they used to be. You know, there's work out there showing on compassion and empathy that since the 1970s, this state has been in decline. And I think if we work to cultivate these emotions, they will just benefit our self-control, both in terms of achieving our own goals, but in terms of forming relationships that will support us along the way. And so that's my argument, right? Don't give up your willpower, but here's a better way to solve the problem.
Well, I love the message, and I really found your book to be very insightful, so I think a lot of people will appreciate your book, Emotional Success, The Power of Gratitude, Compassion, and Pride. And where can people best find you and your work?
Sure, you can find me on the web at www.davedesteno, so davedesteno.com. And on Twitter, I'm at David Desteno, all one word.
Great, okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for being my guest today. It was really a pleasure talking to you, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks for your interest.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. Patreon is like patron with an E, patreon.com/sparkmymuse. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.